So, welcome to Paul McCauley to the Gallants podcast. I'm Marcus Gipps, one of the editors at Gallants, and with me is Paul, author of numerous books, including the recently included in the SF Masterworks series Fairyland, the Quiet War sequence, the Confluence trilogy, some thrillers under the name Paul J. McCauley, I believe?
No, Paul McCauley.
Just Paul McCauley.
No, I dropped the J at the beginning of the century. I don't know why, but I did.
Didn't need it anymore.
I didn't.
And most recently, Austral. I wanted to talk mostly about Austral, as that is the new book, but I wonder if we can start and go back to the beginning a bit and where you started as a writer. You were a botanist, I believe.
Back when I was Paul J. McCauley.
Oh, yes, Paul J. McCauley.
I was a botanist, actually. I'd done a PhD in botany. But before that, well, as a student, I'd actually sold a story. This is so many years ago. It was like in the 70s, I think. But it was to a magazine, American magazine, but that unfortunately, Pop.
Where it got published. Before publication.
Before publication. Actually, when I say unfortunately, I mean actually really fortunately, because it's a terrible story. I later used one sentence in a novel later on, but that was it.
Can you still remember that sentence?
No. Or I'm willfully misremembering it, so I imagine the novel, it's an Eternal Light, which is the third novel, which did sort of share some, because that's the first sort of sequence of things I did, but it was supposed to be a big sort of future history that stalled. No, I didn't exactly stall, but I did what I needed it to do, basically. Mm-hmm. Once you've been to the centre of the galaxy and saved the universe, there didn't seem much else to do.
Your stakes have been raised.
Yeah, that story was part of that, so it's sort of been incubated for a long time. But then I took a lot of time off to do science, and then came back to it while I was still doing science.
And did you write more stories before you started work on a novel, or?
Yeah, so it's the kind of the traditional route of, which I think still holds for a lot of people. Not everybody now, but quite a few people of doing a bunch of short stories and then working my way up towards doing a novel.
And the first novel. That you published,
the first
I should
published
say.
Novel, yeah, because there were two or three which didn't make the cut. The first published novel was 400 Billion Stars, which was sold in the States first.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Actually, it partly explains the J, because a lot of American science fiction writers have middle initials.
Mm.
And I was selling in the States because there wasn't a market. This was in the early 80s, and mid-80s, there wasn't much of a science fiction market until Interzone came along. I mean, there was Glance and a couple of other publishing houses, but there wasn't an awful lot.
Mm.
People weren't, although there were publishing houses, they weren't buying an awful lot of authors in those days. So.
And did you find that they often bought in American stuff anyway that had been...
Good question, actually. I'm not sure. They had their established British writers. And they certainly had their established American writers as well. I don't think they were especially buying a lot of new authors per se until people like Bill Gibson and so on came along and sort of kick-started a whole new generation of science fiction writing.
But so for you, the first book was picked up by the Americans and then later on here?
Yeah, it was picked up in paperback by Del Rey in the States, which is kind of a traditional route for a lot of first-time authors in America. And then Malcolm Edwards,
chairman of
Gallants, of this parish, picked it up for hardback publication by Gallants. In those days, Gallants didn't do paperback, but they sold the rights to Orbit, so that didn't always happen.
No, but it's a good start to the...
So that was a good start, yeah. What happened after that? Oh, it won the Philip K. Dick Award, so that was a good start. What happened since then? It's been a downward trajectory, folks.
Never. You largely wrote sort of quite big science fiction. And with the foray into thrillers for a while, what led you to try something else?
Two things. First of all, I've always been interested in sort of crime novels, and sort of interested in thrillers. Not tremendously interested, because most of them are just excuses for a lot of info dump about stuff I'm not really interested in. Although I do love info dumps, but not about economics and macroeconomics and politics and all the rest of that. Yeah. Like info dumps about geology. And planet science and stuff like that. So they're the wrong kind of info dumps for me. But I do like some. I mean, I'm just reading my way through Martin Cruz Smith and catching up on the ones I missed out on, for instance. So I always had that interest. But what also happened was there was a little bit of a slump in the science fiction fantasy publishing in the 90s. And I just moved to... Am I allowed to say this?
Yes, of course. Another publisher.
Can I say the name?
Yeah.
It's like the BBC. You can't say ATV on BBC. I moved to HarperCollins. And as soon as I moved, they went, could your next novel not be science fiction? Because we decided not to publish any for a while.
Okay.
And I just happened to have written a straight crime novel in like a month in the summer, which was set in the area where I was, in Hackney, where I was living at the time, which was then a very rough, but roughish area. Not tremendously rough, but roughish. And I just wrote a chapter a day, then put it in a drawer and forgot about it.
But as a sort of, as a writing exercise? Or
as a writing exercise, as something to do, yeah. I just finished writing, I think it was just after the Confidence Trilogy, and I kind of had like a momentum going, and I kind of eased down like a big train, you know, slowing down. It's several miles to slow down. And I also thought, well, let's just try writing a crime novel. And it wasn't that great. It had something missing. And so when I was asked to do a crime novel, I sort of came back to it, and I thought, let's do something about terrorism and computers and the internet, and do it sort of post a giant global terrorism incident. And the sort of idea of the novel was it's kind of dystopian thing where information was being rigorously controlled because of terrorism.
And when did you write this book?
It was published 2 days after 9/11.
Wow.
Yeah. So, okay. And so obviously didn't get a lot of publicity.
No.
So, and then I went on to write a few more for Simon & Schuster, again, wanted kind of thriller stuff. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm not quite sure what they really wanted, to be honest, but I was able to get my thriller stuff out. My assistant doing that. I had a straight crime novel as well, you know, straight as I could manage it, which is not very straight.
And there are elements of the crime book in Something Coming Through, which was 3 books ago now, which was a police procedural through a certain prism.
It's a police procedural on another planet. I mean, there's plenty of precedent for sort of police procedurals in science fiction going back. Gosh, I don't know, Caves of Steel, Isaac Asimov. It's probably ones before then as well. I mean, Alfred Bester as well, I suppose, Demolished Man, which is a very, very clever novel about somebody trying to, which is actually relevant to the internet, actually, somebody trying to get away with a crime in an age of perpetual surveillance, but by telepaths, not by computers. So there's certainly plenty of precedent to use a sort of crime novel as a scaffold.
Yes, and
to explore,
set it elsewhere.
Another world. I mean, the useful thing about sort of crime novels is that if you get them right, you've got somebody who mediates between high and low, between the sort of ruling classes or the moneyed classes, people who run the world, and the people at the very low end of the world as well. That's where all the crime happens, and the crime is the thing that links the two. Mm. And the detective is the person who crawls along the thread between the two worlds. So that gives you a way of describing a world without resorting to too much info dumping.
In some ways, I feel Austral brings together a few of those things that we've touched on. It is no doubt a science fiction novel set as it is in the future, but there are elements of thriller in there. There is the chase across the change landscape of the future, and also a sort of a more crime side. You do have the criminal gangs who are chasing after these people for a reason. Felt like it brought together a lot of things that you've been writing about over the years.
Yeah, I was, that kind of sort of somebody makes a terrible mistake and then keeps making a load of more mistakes as she keeps trying to get out of it, and the more she tries to get out of it, the deeper in she gets, which is a very sort of noir-y plot, really. But I wanted to write a science fiction novel which had the arc of a tragedy, which Austral kind of does, because it is about a world that's had a big tragedy, you know, which is world changing, global warming. So the seas have risen, the ice is melting, which is why it's partly set in Antarctica. So it's set in the forests and fields of Antarctica, rather than and the ice fields as well. But the coastal bits of the coast, northernmost coast, have melted and been settled and been planted out. So that's the landscape she's traversing. And it's also about sort of crime in the family history as well, which has sort of indelibly marked her life. She's trying to get out from under that. But as with climate change, the past has a strong grip on the present. So it's a novel also about how the future is. Well, it's about how the present is marked by the past, but in this case, about how the future is marked by our present, which is their past, if you see what I mean.
Yes. And while I wouldn't describe it necessarily as an optimistic book, it does do one thing, which says we will still be here, and we will find ways to cope with global warming. Maybe not particularly pleasant ones always, but human race will survive.
Yeah, well, I think it is actually
hard to write a book where we don't, of course.
Considering if you look around a lot of other novels, climate change or Anthropocene novels, because it's not just climate change, it's the eradication of nature, it's global extinction, the sixth extinction, it's plastic littering everywhere, It's the human civilization is the driving force of change in the world, basically. Not just change in civilization, but geological changes. So the point of the Anthropocene is we've reached a point where we're actually laying down markers in the geological record that in a million years could be read. Talk about the past, catching up with the present,
or
the future. It's optimistic in that, yes, the human race, not only the human race has survived, but civilizations survive in recognizable form. And I've hung hard about whether or not it'd be a different kind of political system. And I decided, no, actually, the point was that the worst thing was that our political system, more or less, and our sort of global capitalistic system, which is the thing that's causing a lot of trouble, had more or less survived.
Mm.
So it was still more or less things were as they are now. And that's one of the things that Austral's mother and was trying to get out from under, and then a group of other people trying to get out from under as well, which is where the hope comes in the end, I think.
It's one of the things I found fascinating about it is that Austral herself is obviously very much on the outside of this civilization for a variety of reasons. But you get glimpses of the political structure and the corruption, which is maybe not endemic, but definitely there. And it feels so relatable.
Yeah.
It feels like it could be now.
Well, again, she's mediated between high and low because she's sort of the lowest of the low. She's a despised husky who's been genetically modified to cope with the still rigorous climate in Antarctica. But at the same time, part of her family is quite high up in the Antarctic Republics. I think it's the Antarctic Republic. I can't quite remember what I called it now. Let's call it the Antarctic Republic. The government, a little bit of Antarctica where she lives anyway. And so there's a connection there. The connection being that, I won't give away too much, but she does something that makes them chase after her as well. So she gets caught by both sides, the low and the high.
And I mean, we don't want to spoil the book, but she flees, and you have this wonderfully evocative description of the landscape she is fleeing over, which is obviously recognisable in its specifics, but very different to what we would expect of the Antarctic Peninsula. One of the people who read it and admired it was the nature writer Robert McFarlane, and I wondered how much that sort of nature writing had impacted on your own writing during this.
It's a good question. I'd read a lot of nature writing anyway because I used to be a biologist, and when I was sort of in my formative years, I was reading science fiction, but I was also reading natural history books. And in those days, well, there was some, but there wasn't the kind of there's been a resurgence, I suppose, actually. And actually, one of the books I read in those sort of formative years was The Worst Journey in the World, which is an Antarctic book.
Yes, yes.
Cheriak Gard, who was one of the members of Scott's doomed expedition. And it's one of the first scientific expeditions, but it's also the race towards the South Pole, which Scott lost. And Scott became, for a while, this big tragic hero. The failure was actually, elevate him as high as success would have done in a way. And as I was growing up in the 70s, slowly that was being chipped away, that kind of monumental edifice of heroism that had been erected on, basically, failure. He succeeded in some ways, but there were lots of mistakes he made in bringing along dogs, being on ponies instead of dogs, trying to use motorized sleds, which very quickly broke down. Mm. You know, he's trying out all these different things, which is admirable, but unlike the Norwegians who pared down their expedition to this one thing they were going to do, it was trying to do a lot of things. And one of the things they were doing, as I said, was science, and one of the science things was trying to collect eggs of emperor penguins to support a now discredited and obscure theory about evolution being recapitulated in embryos.
Hmm.
So these three people set off over this most unforgiving landscape in the worst of winter to try and get these. And The Worst Journey of the World is partly about that, but it's also about the expedition as a whole. You can go and see one of the eggs that was brought back, actually, because they did bring back some eggs. Three, I think. They survived, despite the fact that they nearly lost all their food. They were caught in a tremendous storm. They made a shelter. The roof blew off the shelter. It was worse than anything Austral had to do, and they were genetically modified. But they did bring back three eggs, and there's this very sad scene at the end of the book where it's brought, you know, the egg is brought to the Natural History Museum, and they don't want to take it. So the guy sits there stubbornly in the corridor, you know, nursing the egg for all day until somebody does, just to get rid of it. And now it's in, there's a specific bit in the Natural History Museum in London, which is like a cabinet of curiosities, and there's up. And the egg is part of that. So you can go and see after, the egg, after. The book is sort of about. And that was one of the books that sort of marked me. But yes, there's been a research, and certainly McFarlane is at the cutting edge of it, and I've read several of his books as well. So the idea of landscape and human intervention in landscape, which is partly what's, because what we're talking about now is sort of post-natural nature books in a way.
What we have left behind.
Intervention. But also how human culture and nature sort of mesh together, you know, and it's very interesting on the different words that different bits of Britain use for the same thing, and the words that we use for sort of very subtle changes in the landscape, wind blowing through the grass, the little holes that animals cut through hedges and that kind of thing.
Yeah, the linguistics and the way in which our language has relatively rapidly settled around a fairly common version of English, which has much in common with American English as well, of course, which we import and they take our words. But the variations, the regional variations that he finds are fascinating.
Oh, yeah. And I grew up in Gloucestershire, so and I grew up at a time just when television was coming in and changing all that. So I know, for instance, that they're saying, you know, don't spoil the ship for a ha'porth of tar. Is actually don't spoil the sheep for a ha'porth of tar.
Oh, really?
Because ship is sheep in Gloucestershire dialect, in the dialect of the bit of Gloucestershire I grew up. And it's a big wool-growing area. Okay, it was sheep, you know, they had lots of growing wool.
Yes.
Big sheep farming area, or whatever you call it, and big wool industry. There are mills still there. They used to make all the uniforms for British Army, so the hillsides around where I lived in the 17th and 18th century would be red with all the cloth stretched out to make for the redcoats, the stuff for the redcoats. So you had lots of shepherds. And oddly enough, my grandfather was from a shepherd family, but on the Sussex Downs. Anyway, so to keep blowfly off, you put tar on the sheep's nether regions, okay?
Yeah.
And shepherds carry around this little thing of tar that they dip into to dip in this ha'porth of tar. So don't skimp on the tar, because the blowflies will get the sheep and they'll be spoiled. They'll spoil the sheep and the wool.
I mean, I've always assumed that saying was about caulking the boards, but that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
All right, fascinating.
So yeah, so there's all these dialect words, and there's others as well. Like we had a path called a lago running down the front at the edge of our front gardens. And lager is again a dialect word for a track that goes across a field.
Yeah.
So at one point it was a track going across a field. And it would have been a drying field for the mills, which was just down the road. So this is again the past. Always grown up with this sense of the past there in the present. And I've always thought in the future is not this thing that will be completely redone, renewed, like Brave New World. Well, Brave New World isn't, because that part of Brave New World is that the past does linger on, horrified, looking at what the world has become, but it's still there, even if it's in preserves. But actually, it's stronger than that, I think, as well. So I think part of my books have always been about that as well, to be honest. North Stroud is just sort of crystallisation of all of that.
I've always loved that sense of civilizations being built on the ruins that came before them. I'm a sucker for that. But I think of things like City in the Stars by Clarke, which, although it is Earth, has nothing recognizable within it until you go out of the city and back into the nature, as it were, where you find people who are still well, way, way beyond where we are, but have gone to a slightly more rural way of life and have retained the old traditions in a way that the city dwellers haven't.
Yeah, there's been. I always think there's been a sort of strong strain of the sort of melancholy of ruins in British science fiction. Actually.
Yeah, and sometimes the way in which it's happening. I mean, that's why I think things like Triffids or Death of Grass. You get this image of what will happen when we all vanish and nature starts taking back. Well, I say nature, the Triffids, but or when nature dies, when we have no seed, when we have no grass.
Yeah, well, it's. There are several strands that, I mean, I think actually The Death of Grass is a very tough novel. It's especially the ending.
It's bleak. Yeah, I hadn't realised how bleak it was.
It's not one of those pastoral gamping about in the ruins, not us at all. Because you're right in at the focus of the catastrophe and the same the day of the trip is.
And actually, interestingly,
the day of the trip is holds out a little bit of hope, but hopefully I'm not spoiling things too much here in the death of grass. Not exactly the same thing.
No. But actually, again, a series of bad decisions. Mm. And you see the main characters make decisions which seem to be right, but which you sort of know probably aren't. And it ends in I don't want to spoil it, but in a very shocking scene where they've gone as far as they possibly can and have to make that final decision. And it's an impossible one to make.
Yeah. But having said that, there's still a kind of strain of this the sort of pastoral reversion back to nature, and as you say, the ruins and things. Also, sometimes in American science fiction, I mean, in Book of the New Sun, Gene Wolfe's four books. Well, is it five books?
Four, I think.
Or is it actually nine?
Or is it one?
You can count them all, because there's a lot of them are linked as well, because the Book of the Long Sun is...
It's also a complicated pattern set.
But the original four books, anyway, which is, again, about a journey across the landscape to war, actually. The hero, the torturer Severin, grows up in a keep in which there are towers where I think witches live. I think this is right. I'm remembering this right. And the towers in which the witches live are actually grounded spaceships, rocket ships, proper rocket ships.
Oh, it's been so long.
Yeah. So this is again the sense of the. Because this is set in the far future, where everything is ruined and forgotten. And Michael Moorcock again does this, and John Harrison does this quite strongly.
Ridley Walker by Russell Hoban.
That's true, actually.
One of my favourite books.
In a way, Rob Holdstock as well.
I wanted to ask you about Mythargo Wood particularly, and again that sense of a landscape which is both changing and being impacted upon, but also impacting upon the people who reside in it.
Yeah, it's kind of the memory. It's kind of the memory of the past shapes the landscape, which shapes the people. It's about Hope Wood, isn't it? Where the Mythargos live, who are these creatures shaped of myth and which also shape story and effect.
You're never sure whether the story has formed around them or the
exactly, and people interact with them in strange, very strange ways. They stumble into the wood. And sometimes they leak out to nearby properties and so on. In fact, oddly enough, Robert McFarlane just quoted Holloway's because Rob Holdstock used Holloway's in describing roads that are being set across the landscapes and trampled by the passage of human feet. And there are Holloway's up on a common near where I used to live, where I went to school actually. I was just up there last month. We always said they were tracks. They were tracks of stones hauled towards Stonehenge. Talk about your local myth maze.
Yes.
But they were probably not. It's just where people walked in wagons. Because they're exactly the width of a wagon. They're more or less the width of your standard railway line. So they're proper wagon ways. And there were quarries up on the top of the hilltops then to get the stone down. Yeah. So it made sense that there would be things there. I also think of Keith Roberts as well, Chalk Trance.
Yes.
Like that. I grew up reading all these things in the 70s. There's a little resurgence in the 70s of this kind of stuff as well, which meshed in. So it's very interesting thinking about that. I think that is, although there are examples in American fiction, and you probably think of some others as well, Kim Stanley Robinson's The Gold Coast, for instance, as well, is a modern example. But I think it's a stronger strain in British science fiction writing. This idea that the past is still very close, even in the future, and never quite goes away.
I'm now just we could sit here and think of things. I'm thinking Greybeard by Aldous. I'm thinking Gwyneth Jones, and there's all sorts of people who are mining that. Mining that scene. There you go.
I think as well.
Yes. Yeah. I don't want to give anything away about Austral, and we should wrap up relatively soon. Mm-hmm. But it's a first-person narrative, which could be reasonably described as suspect in places. Mm-hmm. What made you decide to play with the reader in that way?
Well, it's a confession in a way, but in the way of all confessions, even though you're trying to tell the truth, you obviously gild the lily a little bit. So Austral sort of cloaks away her guilt and tries to explain. She's trying to justify what she did, basically. Mm. And the more she tells the story, the less justification she's able to provide, in a way. So gradually things fall away and the truth slowly, I hope slowly emerges, or most of the truth anyway.
So yes, a version of the truth.
A version of the truth. And in between sort of her story, there's this sort of stories from the recent past of her family, and there's also a sort of mythical story that somebody is reading, which has sort of parallels in places her Austral's adventures. And it's set in a much greener Antarctica, a kind of fairy tale Antarctica. A fairy tale, you know, a tale of what Antarctica should be, maybe, what Austral's life should be, a proper heroic tale.
Yes.
That is, despite the fact that's the opposite of what's happening to Austral, it still touches in places with her story as well. So these are those stories as well, which are not quite told in Austral's voice, although it's obvious. I hope that they have a very close relation to what the story is.
Yeah, and I think the echoes and resonance is absolutely there to be seen. And they do provide a fascinating, I'm not quite sure what the word is. I guess it's almost a cutaway from the, I don't want to use the word bleakness, because it isn't a bleak version of Antarctica, the version that Oscar is going through. But it shows a way it could have gone.
Yeah.
I think we're running up to the half-hour mark, so I think we shall leave it there, unless there's anything else you'd like to add.
Well, I just say I don't think it's fantastic. I mean, I'd like to walk the forests and fields of Antarctica myself, although, you know, obviously being able to do so would mean all kinds of bad things for the planet in general.
Yes, and ideally not being chased by various murderous...
Or wolves,
yeah.
But maybe riding a nice little dwarf mammoth across there would be cool. I could do a tourist trip, who knows.
Yeah. Well... Paul McCauley with or without the J. Thank you very much indeed. Austral is out now in paperback and ebook. I highly recommend it. I would, but it's very, very good indeed. Thank you very much indeed for coming.
Thank you.